From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Be on your guard today. It is Friday the 13th, also known as Freaky Friday, and some weird stuff might go down on this show. So if we happen to go off the air or I'm suddenly abducted by aliens...
Well, that was weird.
Just saying, anything could happen. But let's return to our conversation. In the meantime, from yesterday, we talked at length yesterday about the film Captain America: Civil War. That's because the movie challenges audiences to consider their feelings about the role of government in everyday life.
Tony, someone dies on your watch, you don't give up.
Who said we're giving up?
We are for not taking responsibility for our actions. This document just shifts the blame.
I'm sorry, Steve, that is dangerously arrogant. This is the United Nations we're talking about. It's not the World Security Council. It's not SHIELD. It's not HYDRA.
No, but it's run by people with agendas, and agendas change.
That's good.
The movie was inspired by a series of Marvel comics, and we wondered how you feel about illustrated stories as high literature. Here are your first thoughts.
Hey, my name is Wade. I'm in Atlanta. The Watchmen, which is one of the most highly regarded comic book stories and is, in fact, on many top 100 novel lists. It's won all sorts of awards. It is about superheroes, and it is legitimate literature. That's a perfect example.
Sam Burnham tweets this: my wife has a section of graphic novels in her high school library, gets kids reading that might not otherwise. We're actually going to hear more from Sam later on in the break room, but we want to hear from you. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. It's Friday the 13th. That means it's time for...
Georgia Conspiracy Theories.
Shannon Scott joins me. He leads tours in Savannah, and he's a conspiracy theory enthusiast. Hey, Shannon.
Good morning.
I don't think any state is particularly, maybe Nevada, because it supposedly has Area 51, but is Georgia particularly rich in conspiracy theories?
Oh, yes. I mean, we are the 13th colony.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, it was kind of a colony founded by mystics, the Freemasons.
Okay, tell me more about that, because that means what about our history? We have kind of hidden rooms and tunnels everywhere. Nicolas Cage is running about looking for treasure.
Gosh, I hope so, because we need a good movie, you know, about that stuff. out of Georgia anyway. But, you know, Savannah, Georgia, for example, you know, sits at the 33rd degree parallel, which... basically is kind of in accordance with the Grand Master degree of the Freemasons. And, you know, when you really dial back like Georgia's founding, it's kind of like this ancient prophecy of a continent from the times of Egypt, you know, sort of destined for the Masons. And they saw Savannah, Georgia as like the capital city, kind of the holy city, if you will. So, you know, you peel back the old narrative of like Oglethorpe and the colonists, and you really start to see that, you know, they were Freemasons of very high order. They believe that Savannah, for example, was on the same latitude lines as distant Palatine. And they were really ramping up kind of a utopian vision for the colony of Georgia, which, you know, kind of gets skewed by yellow fever along the way. But there's a lot of that mystical heritage throughout the state and a lot of, you know, Masonic lodges throughout the state as well.
So the Oglethorpe you mentioned is the original, James Edward Oglethorpe, who is the founder of the colony
Georgia. Founder of the colony. Yes,
okay, so tell me about a particular conspiracy theory.
Well, I'm particularly drawn to the Guidestones in Elberton, Georgia, which, you know, is the granite capital of the world, and they're sometimes called like the American Stonehenge, although, you know, they were constructed, erected in 1979. And with the advent of the internet since, let's say, 1979, there have been a lot of things hurled at the Guidestones suggesting that they bear inscription, kind of testament of the New World Order and the Illuminati and a lot of nefarious dark things. But when you start to really kind of look at the Guidestones' position in Elberton, Georgia, they really do speak to some benevolent things. And I mean, the man who constructed them, he identified himself as R.C. Christian, which is kind of a throw to Christian Rosenkreuz of basically Austria in the 17th century, who was kind of a founding member of an order called the Rosicrucian Order, which is a very benevolent spiritual order. So I think a lot of the nefariousness that is put on to the Guidestones of Georgia is really more internet overthinking, if that makes sense.
Well, let's hear one of those. Some people think they are directions for creating that new world order that you're describing. Here is Paul Joseph Watson, who is an editor and writer for Infowars.com.
The most ominous guideline reads, quote, maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature, a figure which, of course, couldn't possibly be achieved without either mass genocide or draconian and long-lasting programs of population control, even more extreme than the one-child policy in China.
I mean, for a conspiracy theory to persist, it has to be something like the Guidestones, where there's some sort of mystery involved, right?
Correct. And Joseph Paul Watson is an amazing journalist, and I actually know him and have met him, and I do follow him as well. But that said, he and I have not talked about the Georgia Guidestones together. But you know, when you look at the Rosicrucian Order, the particular inscriptions on the Guidestones, and there are many on different faces of the stones, but they're basically tenets or philosophy expressed in ancient writings of Imhotep, the pharaoh of Egypt, and the perception of the world from, let's say, you know, the late 18th dynasty of Egypt was, you know, let's say, not as we know the world today. So this was an ancient pharaoh leader, basically.
He was chancellor to pharaoh in the third dynasty. Yeah,
correct. Yeah. Sorry, correct. He is looking at the world through, you know, the eyes of then and what would be in harmony with natural law. So that's really where that stuff stems from, you know, and I'm very well acquainted with the Rosicrucians and let's just say their philosophy and outlooks. And I don't think there's anything nefarious to the Guidestones at all.
All right. Well, then let's talk about something which may be nefarious. There is supposedly a Loch Ness type of monster in Georgia. Tell me about that.
Sure. The Altamaha River and River Basin around Darien, Georgia, you know, below Savannah, close to Florida, you know, has, for the past 2,000 years, there's been recognition from the Wally Indians to, you know, early colonists and modern-day fishermen, let's say, talking about a creature which I think in the 20th century they've given kind of a cheeky name to, the Altamaha, get it?
Yeah.
But I mean, I've actually seen, in my opinion, I've seen the Altamaha, and it does fit the description of, let's say, the reptilian creature that has been sighted in those waters.
So here's a little clip of a video that also says they have proof.
This is proof that there's a Loch Ness monster somewhere in Georgia. You see the big hump over there? It's not a gator. It looks like a whale. Not sure what's going on.
My guest is Savannah tour guide Shannon Scott, and of course we want to hear your favorite conspiracy theory. Robert Grizzle tweets his favorite modern conspiracy theory, at least, is FEMA detention camps. Bruce Scherer says his fave is FLOTUS is transgender, which is those not true. But Shannon, let's talk about some. There are conspiracy theories that lasted for years and years and years and ended up being true. I wanted to bring in this clip. This is President Bill Clinton apologizing for the Tuskegee syphilis study at the White House. This was recorded in May of 1997.
What was done cannot be undone, but we can end the silence. We can stop turning our heads away. We can look at you in the eye and finally say, on behalf of the American people, what the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry.
So the Tuskegee syphilis experiments were a conspiracy for a very long time, and people did not believe them.
Right.
So, and yet people, what keeps people, persistent people, returning to try and find that proof?
I think it's a basic love for humanity and humankind and the right to life, let's say.
Does that fit all the conspiracy theory? Does that fit even the search for, let's say, the Loch Ness or the Altamaha?
Well, I think that's human curiosity and wanting to, you know, I think that the curiosity part is connecting dots and following the trail and being enlightened and excited by the information you find. I mean, granted, people have different attitudes in that. I mean, some have a malevolent view of everything. Some have a benevolent view. Some are open to both. You know, so I think the curious nature. But when I think of the Tuskegee, you know, nothing breaks my heart more. And, you know, it's like I weep inside for all the families that lost, you know, because they put trust in, you know, men who showed up with the needles, you know.
And there's a Georgia connection to that story.
There is. Yeah, there's a wonderful wildlife center off the coast of Georgia near Savannah, a few miles, called the Oatland Island Wildlife Center, which is a remarkable wildlife institution and kind of ours due, if you will, although, you know, they don't like that word. I don't really either. But you know, the it's the pre-CDC structure, you know, where the Department of Defense was overwatching a lot of experiments and looking to weaponize probably certain bacteria and things like that. But in the 1940s, there were a lot of women, children, Mexican prostitutes, and different people that died on Oatland Island who had either contracted syphilis or may have been given syphilis. But the blood work of those experiments, the notorious Tuskegee, were done there at Oatland Island.
We have another tweet from Black Physicist who says a favorite conspiracy theory is anything that involves the Illuminati, which often comes up when you're talking about the Masons. But there is a more tangible conspiracy theory that still exists in Georgia, and that's about the Atlanta child murders. Those were making national headlines. Here's a story from NBC News in 1981, and the public still has a lot of questions about that case.
For almost 2 years, the bodies have kept coming out of Atlanta's rivers and woods, and week after week, police speak of sorrow and sympathy, but not a solution.
It's just a tragic, horrible nightmare that we're going through.
We're not in a position today to make an arrest.
There are cases in history that have gone on much longer than this has.
So there is already someone who was arrested and convicted for at least two of those murders. That's Wayne Williams. And yet conspiracy theories persist surrounding the Atlanta child murders. Why?
Well, because it was such a corrupt investigation. You know, there's nothing that really ties Wayne Williams overall to all of the murders that were going on in and around Atlanta at the time. I mean, he was definitely involved with a satanic group. He was also, and this is on public record, that he was CIA. And I kind of see him as a patsy within probably a major child prostitution ring with probably some big names tied to it. But, I mean, after Wayne Williams was arrested, I mean, in prison, 25 other murders of the same style happened in Atlanta. And, of course, as you probably know, that was, I believe Atlanta was the murder capital of the country at that time.
So you believe there's still a killer out there?
I believe there are multiple killers out there, and that's because, sadly, child sex rings are humongous in the world, and even in this country, as much as that, you know, pains me.
Shannon Scott leads tours in Savannah, a storyteller. In fact, you're headed off to a tour now, right? Soon?
I am. It's a beautiful morning here in Savannah. It's hot as heck, but I'm going to put on the black couture suit and go out.
And be careful. Wear your lucky charms because it's Friday the 13th, Shannon. Stay safe.
Yes, yes. Happy safe one.
You too. This is On Second Thought. Other than death. This weekend is the annual Shaky Knees Music Festival in Atlanta. The festival brings a very diverse lineup of musicians. Today, Tennessee native and songwriter Julian Baker. She's only 20 years old, but she's already been featured on NPR Music's Tiny Desk Concerts and got a write-up in the New York Times, among other things.
Ask me where I'd been, like I ask you where you are.
She released her debut album, Sprained Ankle, late last year, and she's in the studio with me ahead of her Shaky Knees performance this Sunday. Hi there.
Hi, Solis. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. You know, from the outside, this all feels really sudden, like this meteoric rise. I wonder if that is what it feels like for you.
Somewhat like that. Yeah, it's been quite the surprising turn of events, like the end of last year and through this year. It's interesting. I just played a show with Forrester back here in Memphis, and having that duality.
The band that you played with before you made the solo album.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. And so, like, still performing with them, you know, it's awesome to get to come back home and play local shows and then play out on tours and stuff. I'm really excited for Shaking Knees. I've never been. It's a quite a big honor for me to be able to do things like that.
I wonder what that transition has been like for you performing these solo songs live. And I ask that because they are so personal, at least listening to them, and gut-wrenching in many, many ways. And I wonder what that's like when you're standing in front of a crowd of, I guess, what's the largest crowd you've been in? At least hundreds, thousands?
Oh, no, not thousands that I know of. I think I would be quite mortified if I had to perform in front of thousands of people.
You would be mortified?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I say it's a God's cosmic joke for a performer to have performance anxiety, but I think it's also, it affords me lots of lessons in humility and transparency, you know? I used to get embarrassed. The first tour I ever did on this record before it was released on a label, I was touring with my friend Ryan Azada, who's also a wonderful local Memphis musician, and we were performing just in these little basements in front of 20, 30 kids, and I would start to get apprehensive and think, perhaps I'm exposing too much of myself, or I'm being too open in a way that might upset or unsettle the audience. But then there's always these moments, and it's continued to happen after shows, especially on this last tour, getting to talk to showgoers and attendees after the performance and hearing about their stories and hearing them relate whatever they got out of the song, you know, whatever the song meant to them. And it motivates me that even though sometimes it's uncomfortable for me on stage to feel like divulging that very intimate part of yourself, you do establish a bond with the people you're performing for. And that's something very precious to me, you know, to be able to share that with people. You make these sad songs, but it doesn't mean you're a sad person. Sometimes you make art that's sad or angry, and it allows you to exercise those emotions in a way that allows you to be well-adjusted and a goofball. And, you know, I can be happy and goofy on stage, and it's all right.
So I wonder, you know, the piano on Go Home, it's slightly out of tune, like it's this loose, jangly tuning, and it fits so perfectly. I wonder if that was a happy accident. Was that just how the piano sounded?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I think so. When we recorded it at Space Bomb, we just recorded at the piano that was available there. But I kind of like it sounding like that, it not being overly produced or perfected.
What is that we're hearing at the very end? Is that a TV?
When we were recording the piano arrangement of the hymn at the end, I heard this like crackly like noise coming over my headphones from the control room.
It was like interference in your headphones?
Yes, ma'am. And so what was happening, I was like, what is that? And I came into the control room and we played it back, and one of the vocal preamps for the mic had been picking up a local church radio station, and it was this televangelist speaking on the radio. And I thought, like, oh, wow, what a serendipitous event to have happened while I'm playing this hymn on piano. And so we left it in there as just kind of a strange, out-of-the-blue production phenomenon. I liked it. I liked the novelty of it.
So the song Rejoice, which I've heard you describe, or I read you describe it as your mission statement, that struck me as almost incongruous, because you'd never expect it from a songwriter who starts. I mean, the song for which your album takes its name begins with, you know, that you wish you could write about something other than death. but Rejoice is your mission statement. Why?
So the song is really about being grateful, even for the things that appear to be misfortunes. I was thinking a lot about that, of how whether we understand the formative events in our life, whether they be negative and traumatic or whether they be positive and obviously beneficial to us, they shape us nonetheless, and we should be grateful. All of my friends in plastic bags, walking around, jumping the train tracks over the... Yeah, I had perhaps some negative or undesirable experiences in my life, but you can choose what to do with that. You can choose to make it into art that establishes a bond between you and another person. You can choose to share that. You can choose to learn from that and make yourself better. So I struggle a little bit with anxiety. And there's a particular passage that I love in Philippians. It talks about rejoicing, and no matter your circumstance, and bringing all of your worries and letting them go. Because even though sometimes it feels like there's no reason to continue, you know, soldiering on, and what we could say is the existential bleakness of life, the futility of trying to be good in a world that is inherently self-defeating, there's still a reason. There's still hope and a motivation.
When your songs are so personal, I wonder what it's like to perform them months and maybe eventually years and years later. Do you think you'd be tempted to change them?
I've been tempted to change them, but I think the reason why I try to preserve them is because even if I've changed my mind about what the songs say, like for instance, there's a song, Good News, and you know, now I think all the time, why did I write a song where I'm just screaming that I ruin everything I do? That's not true, and I don't want other people to sing along because they're singing about thinking that they ruin everything. But at the same time, I can't deny that that was a real and valid emotion that I felt at one time in my life. And though I may not feel that way right now, maybe there is another person that currently feels like they're the only person that ruins everything and their life is a comedy of errors. And if they could relate to that song, then it's worth being honest that sometimes you feel that way. And then you have the capacity to move on if you accept it and confront it. But yeah, there's certain things. I think I was at the Bowery. Perhaps intentionally, and I just didn't realize it. Chose not to say, in rejoice, I think there's a God, but said, rather, I know there's a God. Because it felt like the certainty was really evident in that moment that singing along with everyone, I was aware of something larger than myself, and I chose to be more certain. You know, so there's little things where how dramatically I change the songs, it might vary, you know, from time to time.
Julian Baker will perform this weekend at the Shaky Knees Music Festival in Atlanta. Welcome to Atlanta, and thank you so much for talking to me.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure, ma'am.
I know you're sleeping by now. I'm still up walking around. Walls of my skull been.
You know what? It's been a long week. We talked about viral dance moves. We talked about Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee. We talked about the deeper messages behind the movie Captain America Civil War. Now, let's just sit back, relax, and celebrate Friday. It's time for The Break Room.
The American Academy of Pediatrics says cheerleading causes the highest rate of catastrophic injuries in high school sports.
The new product will also feature the Star Spangled Banner, in case you didn't hear the message loud and clear enough with America emblazoned on the side of the can.
I tell you one thing, if 9/11s were to happen up on this here plane, don't worry, we got this.
Joining us in the break room, Sam Burnham is the curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Tamika DePriest is a marketing and communications strategist. Kalina Baller, co-host of the Real Snobs podcast. And Sumaya Khalifa is executive director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Happy Friday, everyone.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
I bet there's a lot of kids in classrooms that are glad that it's Friday. So let's talk about school, shall we? Because at some point, we all got in trouble at school, right? Did everybody at the table?
Yes.
Yes.
Get in trouble. That was definitive from Kalina. So maybe you got punished, like I did. You'd have to stay late for detention, or you'd have to come in on a Saturday.
Eat my shorts.
You just bought yourself another Saturday, mister.
Crushed.
You just bought one more right there.
Well, I'm free the Saturday after that. Beyond that, I'm going to have to check my calendar.
Good, because it's going to be filled.
Well, Huntington East Middle School in West Virginia is taking a whole new approach to discipline. Instead of suspending kids who get in trouble, the school invites parents to join their kids in class for an entire day. And the school says it has seen suspensions drop by 2/3 since the program went into effect. So let's talk about this. Look, it's not going to be possible for every parent, right? Not everybody can take the day off of work to go spend the day with their kids. But Is it more effective? Would you have been less likely to get in trouble if your parents were going to come and sit in class with you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have to make a point. No, I never got in trouble. But if my parents were asked
you
to come
in, never
to,
got
I
in
never
trouble?
I never did.
I find that hard to believe, Sumaya. It's not like I believe you're untruthful, but come on.
No. Nothing official.
Okay, that's impressive. She got away with it.
Oh, with me, I had that mom. When I was in high school, she was the one that was always volunteering for everything. She was always at the school. It was a matter of, let me go find your mom.
Wow.
See, because she was just very active and involved, and she stayed home with us when we were young. And that made a big difference in me because I knew there's a real good chance I'm going to come around the corner and my mom's going to be standing there. So
and it made you behave.
Oh, absolutely. More than not.
Tamika?
Yeah, well, both of my parents worked, and just the threat of having to take a day to come to the school kept me in check most of the time. But I did get in trouble at school, and I actually begged my grandmother to help me with my situation, which she did, and I promised that, you know, I would never do it again, and it had to do with talking too much. In class
that
and then saying
me.
The wrong thing in mm-hmm. return and having to do a Saturday detention.
Colina?
Oh, I think this just speaks to that parental involvement is, you know, it really helps children, you know, put things perspective and keeps them on the straight and narrow. I know I was, when I got suspended, yes, I got suspended and had several days and evenings and weekends in detention. I was not bad. I just couldn't stay still and I couldn't not talk for a number of years, you know, in class. That said, I was absolutely scared when the threat of my mom or my dad was brought up, like, oh, we're going to make sure they come through.
I think
through.
My son would do pretty much anything to keep me from coming to school. I truly believe he would scrub the floors of the gym before.
And I will also say that I think that some kids act out and continue to act out because they know their parents probably won't be able to come down. They say, oh, I'll tell your mom. Like, yeah, go ahead and tell her. She's not going to do anything. Because there were those kids in my class too. So, you know, I don't know how effective this could be, you know, nationwide, but, you know,
when it works. Speaking of school, let's move on to a subject that does scare a lot of people, math. Last week, I guess the fear got a little too much. An award-winning economist was booted off his flight for doing math equations. A Penn State professor named Guido Menzio was removed from the plane after his seatmate reported him as a terrorist. The accuser saw him scribbling math problems and he thought they were part of a terror plot. So look, I think we can all agree that that was a huge mistake. But the question is, how do we prevent this from happening again? Because it's happened more than once, these kind of mistaken things.
Well, I fly a lot, and I look different. I have the headscarf on. And so it really scares me hearing all those stories. It's almost like can't fly except if you're white and only speak English that everybody understands. So I'm very careful about how I treat people, how I smile at everybody, and not get on the phone and talk to anybody because I might say something that people might misunderstand. It's really a scary time for people who are not from the majority. People of color and people of different faith traditions.
But when you can't even do math, when you can't even do your profession, regardless of what you look like, it's so ridiculous. This story just really made me angry. Oh, and I don't know, I don't remember, did that article mention what kind of math he was doing?
I mean, I saw they showed the page.
Yeah.
I was hard for me to believe somebody wouldn't recognize that as math, but maybe.
Yeah, I was just like, okay.
I'm going to be a little bit startled if I see somebody doing math unprovoked. there a reason? Is this guy taking a test that I don't see the proctor for or something like that?
You distrust someone who does math by choice.
But yeah, if you just kind of, that's a shady guy.
Oh, God. Stereotypes and paranoia is going to be the end of our society.
But his isn't racist. It's just against algebra.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
We're hanging out in the break room. My guests are Sam Burnham. He is curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia and Suspicious of Math. Tamika DePriest is a marketing communication strategist. Kalina Bowler is co-host of the Real Snobs podcast. And Sumaya Khalifa is executive director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. As always, you are always welcomed to join the break room. You can give us your thoughts on either a parent spending the day in school with their kid or scary math. You can reach us by tweet at OST Talk or call us or post on Facebook. And a special thank you to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that fuels our break room guests and their brains in the morning. They are online at savannahcoffee.com. All right. Well, the saying goes that everything is bigger in Texas, at least is the saying that Texans made up. That also includes budgets for high school football fields at this point. Voters in Texas just approved a $220 million bond package to finance the nation's most expensive high school stadium. I mean, football is a big deal in Texas. It is a big deal, even high school football here in Georgia. But is this a good use of $220 million in borrowed money? Taxpayer money?
No.
Not at all.
No, everyone says no.
No, and I'll tell you, in full disclosure, I'm a huge football fan, college and high school. And I even attended college on a scholarship working with our football team at the university I attended. I think athletics are very important to the total education of a student, but this is excessive.
Yeah. Everyone's agreed.
Especially considering the average cost for high school stadiums, according to Education Week, is more in the $5 to $10 million range, which I thought was pretty expensive, but I understand, you know, the need for these facilities and what they can offer in terms of the educational experience. But this is a trend in Texas. So in 2012, $60 million for one, $62 million for another, a couple of years later, $50 million, and then this one. So it seems like there's even a chase,
or competition. Somebody's trying to get the most expensive.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I even saw it mentioned where the guy said, well, they got one in Plano. All another town's got it, so we have to have it too. And I can tell you, being involved in football as long as I was, I got embarrassed on some cow pastures and had some great triumphs in some fancy stadiums. A fancy stadium is not going to make your football team win.
That's a good point.
Okay. I like to look at the graduation rates for that area.
Now, that's academics. What does that have to do with high school?
Oh, God, I forgot.
Yeah, well, how about teachers' salaries and all that? I mean, the money could be better spent.
Arts education.
Yes.
You guys hate football. All right, let's talk about arts, specifically pop arts. Singer Lauryn Hill, she's already notorious for being late to her shows well past the time they're supposed to start. But here in Atlanta, she showed up almost 2 hours late for her most recent concert.
There's never a disrespect to you when we are late. We are struggling, we are hustling, we are moving every day. And we have to take care of ourselves in the process. You want to know something? There is resistance. So it is not easy.
Okay, so a bunch of audience members yelled at her to her face because eventually, after they'd paid full price for their tickets, she only gave a 30 or 40-minute performance. But she is not the only one. Look at Kanye is late a lot. We got a tweet from a listener who says, late pop artists, you must bring up Madonna. Not sure if she apologized for her 3 hours late Atlanta show. Hashtag ridiculous. Hashtag unacceptable. So this is my question to you. There are a good group of pop artists who are really regularly late all the time. Is it do we expect it of an artist? Is it acceptable?
I don't expect it. But I do know that Lauryn Hill actually has a brand for being late. And I had a friend, when this person bought their ticket, said, if I get 27 minutes, I'm good. And so there are some who love an artist so much that they tolerate it. I mean, I wouldn't. I think Prince is a great example of someone who did two shows in Atlanta in one night on time and gave the audience, you know, the return on their investment. These tickets are not inexpensive.
They are not. Cameron tweets, it will make me think twice about buying a ticket for her next tour.
I'm going to say this. I don't go to concerts often at all. I know that this is a big moneymaker for a lot of artists. But it's just my personal thing. I just don't go to concerts. So if I were to purchase a ticket and I were to want to go, I would expect, okay, you can be like 10, 20 minutes late. You know, sometimes there's technical things. I get it. But if you're going to disrespect your fan base and you're going to disrespect that audience and be that late, and then you're consistent on top of that, like you said, I just, that does not compute with me. It makes no sense. I will just stay home and I will watch on pay-per-view or Hulu or whatever.
Right. Remember where you came from and remember who helped you get
there.
Thank
you.
Okay. Let's move on.
I'm not angry.
The reason that she gave too is that her driver did not know the way. But 2 hours? Come on.
No. Well, that's kind of bogus because she had a sound check and she was on time for the sound check at the arena.
And she did a Facebook post to say that it's about energy. And so
she doesn't have her energy.
Yes. And she doesn't have control over when that artistic flow is going to come out.
Okay, she needs to have several seats. I'm sorry.
Do it on
Periscope.
And
I love Lauren. She needs to have absolutely all the seats. This is stupid.
Okay. Also, referring to the earlier topic about expensive football stadiums, Lynn Durham tweets, $220 million on a high school stadium is why Americans do not recognize math equations when they see them.
Love it.
Come on. I oppose the $220 million stadium. I'd like to point that out.
Okay. Speaking of football fields, when we talk about safety on the football field, almost always we're talking about football players, right, and head injuries. But it turns out cheerleaders are the most likely to sustain a concussion above all other athletes at the University of Georgia. Many of the maneuvers that they do just during regular routines make them really susceptible to brain injury. And I wonder who's surprised by this, and is there a reason that we don't talk about it more?
I was very surprised about it, but once I did read about it, it made sense because we look at cheerleaders, they're happy people, they make everybody cheer and go rah, 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 and they're always smiling, they're always there with a high level of energy, and nobody really thinks about them as a sport or being injured. So it is it's an image that is portrayed as being healthy, happy, and there.
Although there's lots of tumbling and
they wear no protective equipment.
Yes, right. And acrobatics. And I didn't think of it either until I read the USA Today article. But so I was very surprised. I'd been focused on football concussions.
Yeah. Well, the football concussions are the ones that you see happen on camera while a cheerleader is over in a corner of the stadium, and the only people that are going to see an accident or an injury are the fans that are there at the game.
It also occurs to me, and I was a cheerleader, it also occurs to me that cheerleaders are often operating on not very safe material. They're just on whatever is there at the side of the field, which is sometimes pavement.
I'm wondering about the training of their coaches or like the cheerleading staff that train them. Yeah. So you're laughing.
I'm talking about the high school level. I'm sure
school,
college
right.
cheerers
and
very
competitive.
Well,
I'm sure they know what they're actually doing. But like, you know, high school, middle school cheerleading coaches, they're like, all right, we're gonna try a double. I was not a cheerleader. I don't know. So we're gonna try a double.
They get somebody's
thing.
Mom who did
that's what
gymnastics
I'm saying
as a kid.
Yeah. Right, and then I don't know if they're really training them properly, not just on the maneuver and the move itself, but safety. And that's something you would start to find probably as you get more to the professional level. Because cheerleaders are athletes through and through. That is difficult stuff. And
yeah.
And if you are not properly trained or conditioned and ready to do that, I can see so many injuries happening. I mean,
yeah, if your child is in cheerleading, either male or female, and you want to be frightened, go read the statistics on injuries.
Right.
It is Friday. We are in the break room. My guests are Kalina Baller of the Real Snobs podcast, Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, and Tamika DePriest, marketing and communications strategist. So how long has it been since everyone's been in college? 10 years, 20 years, maybe? 70-year-old Hurl Taylor is an attorney from Atlanta. Last week, he received the 8th college degree of his lifetime. Taylor's most recent degree is in theology from the University of Emory. He served as one of the lead defense attorneys in the Atlanta Public Schools cheating scandal, but he says he keeps going back to class because he wants to keep his mind sharp and he loves to learn. And we wondered, if you head back to school, what would you major in? What subject do you think would interest you more later on in life?
We're going streaking through the quad and into the gymnasium. Come on, everybody!
Yeah, streaking is not a major, not a qualified major. But what would we go back to school for?
Film studies.
Interesting. Tamika would study film. Sam?
I'm going to go with literature.
Not math?
Not math. That would be a waste of someone's time and effort.
Oh, I think you should consider it.
Samaya, what would you go back and study?
I think art.
Interesting. Yeah. What kind of art?
I would love to learn how to draw and understand the concepts behind it.
Interesting. Kalina?
I would absolutely study botany.
Botany?
Botany.
Plants.
Yes. As I got older and I was looking for a way to relax from the stressors of my life in the film industry, interestingly.
How about that? That's trade.
Getting out in the dirt, being in my garden, you know, getting out among trees and plants has actually helped me a lot. And I said, if I could go back to school, I would absolutely study the science of plants and nature.
That is fascinating. You can tell us what would you go back to school to study? You can tell us, tweet us at OSD Talk, call us, or post on Facebook. Meantime, let's move on to beer, which is also often synonymous with college. Anheuser-Busch, one of the biggest sellers of beer in the world, and the popular brewer has obviously marketed their product pretty successfully over years. You know, the famous Clydesdale horses, very recognizable. They had a group of croaking frogs. And then there was that one really popular phrase a few years back.
So, but you?
Nothing. Watching game, having a butt.
True. True.
What's up? What's
up? So there's...
I love it.
Anheuser-Busch is trying a new marketing tactic that's kind of tied to the 2016 Summer Olympics. The company's applied to change the name on the labels of the beer from Budweiser to America. Now, this is a little ironic because the company is not American-owned anymore, but what do we think? Would you want to knock back a cold bottle of America at the end of a day?
Go ahead.
I'm not sure about that. But, I mean, Bud is already iconic, you know, as a patriotic brand. So I don't think it's going to hurt them. I mean, they're sold at sports games, baseball specifically. It's already very American, even though it was sold to, you know, an international company not based here.
Okay. Anybody else tweet about? I mean, look, does patriotism
sell beer? I had a lot of America
beer?
When I was in college. And I'm kind of grown, I think, into a bit of a snob in that area. So I'm probably going to go with some more of the local guys on that one.
Okay. But patriotism, does it sell? But look, what about other countries? Are in France, are they going to be buying America?
They could. It could work. Okay.
But if you're in France, are you going to drink
Budweiser? You guys are unconvinced by anything I say today.
Okay, here we go. I think it's a smart strategy in that there are so many statistics and things out there that talk about how America is so divided. And I think that they are playing off of that, and they're trying to say, hey, if it's anything we can unify about, it's like watered down beer, you know? And, you know, the fact that we can knock a few back when we're celebrating, whether or not it's an actually good celebration, it's so American. And why not, right?
Bad beer. Okay. Yeah. All right. Maybe we can unify around naked baby pictures. Look,
what?
The easiest way. Here's the thing. Hear me out here, because I think the number one easiest way to embarrass your children, right, is to start showing their baby pictures.
That's true.
Oh, yes.
That's true.
And, you know, your kids come over with a date and there's the naked baby picture on the wall. There's not much the kid can do about it. But the French government now says parents could be liable if those photos get posted on social media like Facebook. Officials in France say non-consenting children deserve a measure of privacy when it comes to social media, and if parents break the law, they could face not only hefty fines, but prison time. So what do we think? Do they have a point? We've got about 3 minutes to discuss this, but do we think France has a point?
Yes, because in today's age, there are predators out there that can easily take those pictures and use them for, you know, not so good things. So
one vote for no naked baby pictures.
Don't do it.
Okay, Samaya?
Use common sense, and I think it's happy day for our friend's lawyers. The lawyers will have a great day.
Mm.
More business. True.
Get this money.
I don't know about a law enforcing it, but some common sense says these are the people going to be taking care of you when you're old.
Kids may appreciate it later. It's good to have a choice. Let me post my naked baby pictures if I want to.
Really? You want to be able to post naked baby pictures, right?
Not
go to prison?
and not go to prison.
I actually have a friend who specifically will not post any pictures, naked or not, of her daughter. You know, she said she's not going to, I'm not going to put all her pictures out there. I'm going to leave it up to her when she's of age and she wants to make her own social profiles on the internet, whatever.
See, and that's sort of the argument is like when the kid gets to 18, if a parent's been posting a lot of photos that could influence their ability to get a job, their right. ability to go to college, that's the fact that they had no right of refusal and their parents are posting them.
I think they should have right of refusal.
You do, the five-year-old? Because there's this great picture of my son in a bunny suit that I wish...
the bunny suit is not, you know, the naked picture.
But he would absolutely object to that.
It looks like a pink nightmare.
Let him have choice.
All right. Well, in the minute that we have left, I don't know if you've heard, but KFC, Colonel Sanders, is now offering edible nail polish. Have you heard about this, right? They have two flavors available in Hong Kong, nail polish that's flavored like original recipe or hot and spicy. So our question is, in the lightning round, would you buy it, wear it, and eat it? Tamika?
Absolutely not.
No. Sam?
No.
No?
No, but make it a honey mustard and we'll talk.
Oh, okay. Maybe. It's the flavor she has a problem with, Sumaya.
Can you imagine sitting around and having people licking their fingernails?
They do that now.
Here, try this.
That's so horrible.
Mine is great. Try mine.
That is so gross and so unhygienic. It's really awful.
I understand it goes with the whole finger licking good, but... No, thanks.
Well, so only in Hong Kong, guys.
Okay, we are out of time in the break room today, although you can always respond, especially if you're all for the original recipe fingernails, let us know. Our guest today, Sam Burnham, curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Tamika DePriest is marketing and communication strategist. Kalina Bowler, co-host of the Real Snobs podcast. And Sumaya Khalifa, executive director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great weekend.
If you want to respond on the KFC fingernails or anything else, you know how to reach us, 404-500-9457, Twitter, @OST Talk. For today and the week, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great weekend, guys. You work well,